Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight in this somewhat cold evening to hear Carl Bridge, who makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. Now, he's known to many of you, but he's Professor of Australian History at King's College in London. Now, he's written about three books and edited many others, but most recently, the Peace Conference of 1913-1923 and their aftermath, focusing on Billy Hughes, Australia. Now, currently, Professor Bridge is preparing a book of official documents, Australia in Peace and War, 1914-1919, which is the biggest collection of documents involving Australia's diplomatic role in the First World War. And some of that material comes from this book, and some of that material will be in the new book. But because he's looked at the biggest collection of Australia's role in Versailles, and tonight's topic is Billy Hughes at Versailles, the new evidence. Professor Bridge, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared. It's a great pleasure to be back in Sydney, although I am a Sydney sider. It's a long time since I lived here. It wasn't Menzies who was Prime Minister, but almost. So it's a while. Billy Hughes, Australia's Prime Minister for most of the First World War, one of the noisiest and most controversial of our Prime Ministers, but also of the smaller nations delegates at the Paris Peace Conference in 1919. At the end of the war. We call it the Versailles Conference, but in fact it's the Paris Conference because most of it didn't happen at Versailles. They just signed the stuff at the end in the Hall of Mirrors. He famously crossed swords with the United States President, Woodrow Wilson, over Australian territorial ambitions in the Pacific, over war reparations, and over the insertion of a racial equality clause in the preamble to the League of Nations Charter. In his memoirs, and a lot of stuff about Hughes is based on his own memoirs, beware of these things. In his memoirs, Hughes portrays himself as a sort of Antipodean David fighting a lone battle against the American Goliath, Wilson, and winning against insurmountable odds. Gets New Guinea. Defends white Australia. Doesn't mention the reparations much because he doesn't get any of those, but that's there too. Many historians have chosen to endorse this account because it's easy to do so, and it chimes in with Australian nationalist mythologising. A comprehensive assessment of the full documentary record for Versailles, however, hasn't really been done because it requires a great deal of multi-archival research around the world. DFAT commissioned me and a team of six other historians to do this for 2019, but unfortunately I was in hospital with lymphoma for 6 months last year, so the book hasn't come out, but it's on the stocks. 1,000 pages of documents, a fifth of which is Versailles, so some 150 documents on Versailles, based not only on the Australian archives, but on the British ones, and the American ones, and the French ones. What we found in doing the project was that two-thirds of the Australian-generated documents we found in London and the US were not in the Australian archives. Our archivists or our prime ministerial secretaries were not capable of keeping their records sufficiently during the First World War. The Hanke Revolution had not happened in Australia, if you know about it. Hanke had happened in Britain. We caught up with Shedden 20 years later. So you need to find the Australian records elsewhere, even though we wrote them, a lot of them. Now, this volume will be published in the Documents in Australian Foreign Policy series, and it reveals what I think is a more interesting and much more politically believable story about Hughes. It doesn't diminish him, but it shows up different aspects of his operation. First, a little background about Hughes. Hughes was in the group of Labor MPs elected to the initial federal parliament in 1901. He'd been an MP in New South Wales before that. So he's an MP in New South Wales in the early 1890s. He's still an MP in federal parliament in the early 1950s. So had a good long political career. Somebody kept electing him. Everyone says he was a Labor rat, but somebody kept electing him, and he won as Prime Minister during the war and after it, three general elections. So he must have got something right. Now, all the caricatures of Hughes, yes, he was like that, but he used those things in order to deliver for the Australian electorate. Now, among the first acts passed by the Barton Liberal government, 1901, was the Immigration Restriction Act, White Australia policy, which sought to control non-European migration by means of the 50-word dictation test in a European language, later on a prescribed language. And if they didn't want you to get in, they tested you in Gaelic or something, couldn't speak. Had trouble with Kish later on, if you remember, because he spoke every language there was. Hughes approved this legislation. Now, interestingly, in his speech approving of it, he says that of the Japanese, as alien competition aims, this is a quote, aims a blow at the very basis of our industrial system, we oppose it. So he's opposing it not on racial grounds so much, but on the grounds that it's competition with the Australian workforce. And not on account of their colour or religion, he says. This is in Parliament, because that would be absurd. That would be absurd. We're doing it because it's going to undermine our wage conditions. And the easiest way of telling is to say nobody from Japan can come, nobody from China, and so on. So he feared the Japanese with their technical skills, their strong work ethic, and their sheer numbers, saying they might swamp white Australia, the white Australian outpost. He thought that British Australia needed the white Australian legislation to protect its very existence. He wasn't the only one. Virtually all MPs, no matter which parliament, which party you came from, argued that. The crushing Japanese naval victory over a powerful Russian fleet in the Battle of Tsushima in the Sea of Japan in May 1905 signalled to Australians and the rest of the world that Japan had arrived as a major power. Beat the Russians, beat a European, first-ranked European nation. For Australian politicians with a geostrategic sense, such as Hughes, and Alfred Deakin, it was now clear that though nominally an ally by virtue of the Anglo-Japanese Treaty of 1902, Japan was now the greatest potential threat to Australian security. They were alarmed rather than reassured when, after the renewal of the treaty in 1905, the British withdrew ships from the Pacific in order to better counter German naval growth in the North Sea, arguing that Japan could protect British interests in the Far East. Tsushima triggered a major acceleration of Australian defence preparation. In 1906, Deakin decided to follow Hughes's earlier advice and initiate plans for a modern, freestanding Australian Navy, the first Navy in the British Empire outside Britain. By 1907, he followed Hughes a step further and also advocated compulsory military training for all male citizens. Compulsory military training for all male citizens for the defence of the homeland. 2 years later, Field Marshal Lord Kitchener, British Field Marshal, reported on Australia's defence needs, recommending a home defence force of 80,000 men raised by compulsion. In the initial debate on Deakin's defence plans, Hughes was at his cold-eyed, warm-blooded, forensic and rhetorical best. Even if they were in Australian waters, and this wasn't guaranteed, the mostly antiquated vessels of the British Pacific Squadron were, he said, only fit for the scrap heap. That was his term. A proper Australian Navy was imperative to build our own. or get the British to build it for us and pay them for it. Borrow the money from the British and get them to build it for us, pay it back later. Further, he put his argument with Bismarckian realism. I'll quote him. By what virtue are we here today, here in Australia, except by brute force? We came here and displaced those who were placed in possession by hand of providence. And we talk about peace? We've arrogantly declared that this is to be a white man's country. There are 4,200,000 of us, of whom 21,000 bear arms. We debar the coloured nations from entry. To the 400 million Chinese, to the 40 million Japanese, flushed with their triumph over a country that humbled every other country in Europe in its turn. We've said you mustn't come in. And the weapon with which we propose to keep them out is an act of Parliament. Beyond that, we have no means of making good our boast. If the White Australia policy is to be a permanence in this country, there must be behind it a sufficient force of white Australians ready to make good their claim. Direct, in your eye. This initiative led in due course to the inauguration by Hughes in 1910, in the Fisher Labor government, of compulsory military training for youths aged 11 to 17 and adults 18 to 26. This was a veritable manpower revolution. And between 1911 and 1915, some 636,000 Australians had been trained. What's the size of our army today? 636,000. So they're the ones that we draw on to fight the First World War. This compulsory military training scheme was a significant departure from British practice and unique in the British Empire. Deakin had failed to legislate for a navy. First Fisher government had, in 1908, endorsed plans for coastal protection, so-called Brown Water Navy. Deakin's successor administration invited the 16 battleships of the American Great White Fleet, called White Fleet because it was painted white, to visit Sydney and other Australian ports. The new Australian Navy, initiated in 1910 by the Fisher government, but in fact by Hughes, who was acting Prime Minister, Fisher was away in South Africa when it happened, resulted in the Battlecruiser Australia, the strongest single vessel in the British Empire, in the Pacific at the time. Battlecruiser Australia, 3 light cruisers, 6 destroyers and 3 submarines, all of which arrive in the Sydney Heads, just out here, October 1913, just in time. The Royal Australian Navy is formed. With these plans well in train, Hughes announced in Parliament with some considerable satisfaction and a little exaggeration that, quote, we have placed a fleet on the water and an army on the land, the like of which has not been seen in our time, unquote. Should Japan now turn hostile, and Hughes and Fisher were not at all reassured by the renewal of the Anglo-Japanese Treaty in 1911, it would now need to send much more than an invading army of a division or two. Hughes becomes Prime Minister in Australia in October 1915, and in early 1916 and again in 1918 and 19, he visits London and then Paris. There he aimed to press Australia's case over Japan for the annexation of the former German colonies in the Pacific and to clinch a number of major commodity export deals, including the biggest wheat export deal that had ever been done at that time. Hughes sold huge quantities of Australian wool, wheat and minerals, but was less successful over the German Pacific Islands. The islands north of the equator, the Marianas, Carolines and Marshalls, had been occupied by the Japanese soon after the outbreak of war. This was despite their having been ceded to the British Empire at the German capital, Rabaul, which Australians, of course, took. New Zealanders took Samoa. The British had agreed in 1915 to support the Japanese keeping the islands that they had occupied. This was formalised in a secret treaty in February 1917, and in return for the dispatch of a Japanese destroyer flotilla to the Mediterranean. So the British want the Japanese involved in the war in Europe. The British were less than forthcoming about this to Hughes. We haven't promised it to them. We said we'll back their view at Versailles or at the peace treaty, peace negotiations after the war. Hughes said we'll wait and see. In May 1918, so we're getting there. In May 1918, en route to Britain via the United States, Hughes was taken by Lord Reading, the British ambassador, to meet the American president, Woodrow Wilson, whose country had joined the war on the Allied side in 1917. Reading reported to London. Mr. Hughes impressed upon the president that it was vital to the security of Australia that Germany should never be allowed to take any part of New Guinea or the islands of the Pacific. Mr. Hughes made plain that Australia wasn't seeking all the islands for herself, that she had sufficient territory of her own, but that her life would be menaced if Germany, with her predatory designs, held any of these islands. And he emphasised the necessity of these belonging only to the British Empire and friendly powers. Wilson was totally non-committal. He sat there, listened. In his memoirs, Hughes gives us a more graphic version. He says, "President Wilson received me courteously, and when after a few non-committal words I ventured to set out the views of the government of the Commonwealth of Australia on the future of the islands of the Pacific, he heard me in silence, listening intently to all I said, but remaining as unresponsive as the Sphinx in the desert." Wonderful. Keith Murdoch, you know, Rupert's father, the Australian journalist and Hughes's unofficial go-between in London, had told Hughes, who didn't need telling, that he would, quote, "have trouble with Wilson over the German Pacific Islands if there is no propaganda. Have trouble, there's no propaganda." This advice Hughes would act on to great effect. He soon made two tub-thumping speeches in the United States calling for an Australasian Munro Doctrine for the South Pacific and for a full indemnity from Germany to pay for the war. Germans started it, they've got to pay for it. Both elements flying completely in the face of the liberal internationalism of Wilson's 14 points, to which we'll return. Apoplectic, Wilson, we now know from the British archives, asked his Secretary of State to investigate banning Hughes from returning from Europe via the United States. Lansing, the Secretary of State, said, we can't do this, sir, Mr. President. He's an ally. He's the leader of an allied country. As it turns out, Hughes doesn't go back through the United States. He stays in London and goes off to Paris. So he stayed in Europe to work his mischief there instead. In London from June 1918 until the end of the war, Hughes met in the Imperial War Cabinet with his peers from Britain and the self-governing dominions, Canada, New Zealand, Newfoundland and South Africa. He argued for an increase in technology. Australia's running out of troops by this stage. Conscription hadn't been introduced. So you want more aeroplanes, more tanks and more artillery. Beat the Germans with technology as a means of winning the war. Lloyd George said to him, "But the Americans have promised 120 divisions. Surely we're going to win with them." He said, "Well, let's win before the Americans get involved in the war, otherwise the price will be too high." Quite interesting. General Monash's copybook, All Arms Victory at Hamel on the 4th of July. 4th of July, did it on purpose, had some Americans helping him. No fool, Monash. This victory bore these things out. If you use your aircraft and use your tanks, you're going to win. A month or so later, the German offensive is being pushed back, and we have the Black Day of the German Army, Schwarzer Tag, the German Army, the Battle of Amiens, the 8th of August. War's ending. Hughes supports calls for direct access to the British Prime Minister by Dominion Prime Ministers. We don't want to go through the Governor General anymore, we want to talk to the Prime Minister directly. But he opposed Jan Smuts, the South African representative's ideas for a political imperial federation. Don't want to do that. This will affect Australian sovereignty. We can't sacrifice our sovereignty. I heard that argument recently in Britain. Anyway, there it is. On the Pacific Islands, prompted by a Japanese official statement claiming the islands north of the equator, Hughes wrote confidentially to Lloyd George, outlining in detail the strategic reasons why the Japanese should be denied. The main base at Truk in the Carolines was closer to Townsville than it is to Yokohama. Sailing time from Japan to Australia would be more than halved, and with it, the potential military threat would be doubled. In the Imperial War Cabinet meetings, Lloyd George reiterated that it was the Empire's policy to hold on to the former German territories it had occupied south of the equator, but that it had to honour its 1915 understanding, reaffirmed in 1917. All of these matters came to a head at the Paris Peace Conference, beginning in January 1919. The modus operandi of the conference was that the old Supreme War Council of the principal allies continued as the conference's Council of Ten. These are the five prime ministers and their five foreign ministers. So US, Britain, France, Italy and Japan. The Japanese didn't attend all that much, only turned up when they were on the agenda. There was also a series of plenary sessions and a range of commissions set up to report on specific issues, such as the League of Nations, reparations, adjustment of borders and so on. Prior to the armistice, Wilton's 14 points had prescribed a policy of no annexations. No annexations is going to be new sort of peace treaty. No annexations, no indemnities, no secret diplomacy. Despite this, among similar claims from many nations, Australia, South Africa and New Zealand wished to keep the strategically important German colonial territories close to their borders, which they had occupied early in the war, New Guinea, Southwest Africa and Samoa. Japan had a similar case over the islands north of the equator, and also, interestingly, over Shantung. Now, Shantung actually was part of China. It wasn't a German colony, it was a concession. But they wanted that to be a mandate as well. Became a reason why the Chinese didn't sign the Treaty of Versailles. In Paris, Wilson was attracted to the idea first canvassed by Smuts in a paper written before the conference, which suggested that the Ottoman territories in the Middle East should become mandates of the new League of Nations. Mandates reporting to the League of Nations on their progress towards self-government. Why can't we do that with all imperial territory? Americans didn't have much empire at this time. We had lots. French had lots. What was Hughes to do? On the 24th and 25th of January 1919, by invitation, Hughes addressed the Council of Ten on Australian territorial claims. Using a large map of the Pacific, which had Australia at its centre, had to go to the Royal Geographical Society and have it specially made, Australia at the centre, everybody else around us. Very good if you're Australian. Using that map, he pointed out that the islands, quote, the islands encompassed Australia like fortresses. As Ireland is to the United Kingdom, as Mexico is to the United States, as Alsace-Lorraine is to France, so is New Guinea to Australia. Wilson replied, a couple of days later, next meeting, with a story about a man who kept buying real estate because he couldn't bear the thought of anyone else owning land adjacent to his. And he said Hughes's attitude was based on a fundamental lack of faith in the League of Nations, which didn't exist, of course, at this point. Any attack on the mandate would incur the League's wrath, and the United States would join anybody in dealing with the attacker. That's if they join the League of Nations, but that's another story. Wilson's private thinking, however, and we know this from the American archives, was much less altruistic. In a pencil note on a memorandum supplied to his by his principal advisor, Colonel House, Wilson had written, "My difficulty is with the demands of men like Hughes and certain difficulties with Japan. The latter loom larger. A line of islands in her possession, Japan's, would be very dangerous to the United States." In other words, he wants the Japanese islands to be mandated so that the Americans have control over those islands through the League of Nations. Very different view of what's going on. Vili want to annex New Guinea. The Americans wanted to manage it, make it part of their empire, but not say so. Familiar. We're not imperial. Just control most of the world. We're not. Thank you, Jeff. So clearly Wilson was keen to have mandates imposed more as a means of circumventing the Japanese than of controlling the dominions. In subsequent meetings, the French said that Hughes had made their case for the Cameroons and Togoland. The Japanese said that he'd made their case for the islands north of the equator. And the Italians said that he'd made their case for Dalmatia. A split with the United States was imminent. Lord Eustace Percy, one of the British Empire delegation, noted that the mandates idea, quote, seemed in danger of splitting on the rock of South African and Australian nationalism. He should have added French, Italian and Japanese to boot. According to an article by Murdoch in the Melbourne Herald, not an unimpeachable source, but the best we've got, French President Georges Clemenceau whispered in Hughes's ear, "You made a strong case." One of Hughes's advisers, one he didn't listen to, Frederick Eggleston, wrote in his private diary that Hughes is being used as a cat's paw by the French. He didn't observe, however, that Hughes knew full well that this was what was happening and that it was to all the Allies' mutual advantage. So Hughes is being used as it were, the front runner to take the flak for the other parties. And he knows it, and he does it, and he does it well. He does it over New Guinea, and we find he does it over other things as well. The official record shows that the C-class mandates, they divide them up into A, B, C, the C-class mandates, which is what New Guinea becomes, are mandates that are under the law of the company of the country that controls them. So Hughes gets to control immigration to New Guinea tariffs, anything else to do with New Guinea under Australian law, and Hanke says to him at the time, the C-class mandate was the equivalent of a 990-year lease. 990-year lease. Not quite true, although we still do send a lot of aid to New Guinea. And maybe there is a 999-year lease operating there somewhere. So no surprises in the end. Mandates are given to Australia for New Guinea, New Zealand for Samoa, and Japan for the Marianas, Marshall Islands and Carolines. The Japanese also get Shantung eventually, and this, as I said earlier, antagonised the Chinese. Viscount Chinda, one of the Japanese members, tried to hold out for freedom of entry for Japanese into New Guinea in the C-class mandates, but failed. It's not until December 1920, well after the conference finishes, in June 1919, that the mandates issue is finally solved in detail. Now, as Hughes saw it, Japan mounted a two-pronged assault on Australian policy. The other prong was Japan's campaign to have a racial equality clause inserted in the League of Nations covenant. Such a clause, however benign, in Hughes's view, might have been used to mount a legal challenge to Australia's restrictive immigration laws, initially as applied to the mandate and perhaps ultimately to Australia itself. The Japanese first proposed a draft clause to House and Wilson in February 1919, and this was massaged into what appeared to be an innocuous affirmation of the all men are created equal variety in the preamble to the League of Nations Covenant. The Americans and the Canadians, who had immigration restriction acts of their own, agreed to this going into the preamble. Preamble isn't legal, one thing. Also, they had gentlemen's agreements with the Japanese, so the Japanese didn't mind having this clause. They wouldn't activate it, as it were. Hughes didn't believe him. So the United States and Canada had their own racially restrictive things. Australia and New Zealand contest this. They say, we're not going to put this in. Think about this with the Australian Constitution and the preamble and the Aborigines and all of that. That was interesting. That didn't happen there either, perhaps for similar reasons. Now, interestingly, Jan Smuts, the South African, sotto voce, doesn't approve this either, but he doesn't go into bat. He doesn't have to go into bat because Hughes is doing it for him. Neither does the New Zealander. Neither, interesting enough, do the Americans. The Americans also have a racially restrictive immigration policy. particularly keen are the West Coast Americans, Californians, Oregon, so on along there. They're worried about Japanese and Chinese immigration. Hughes says to Wilson, if you don't allow this, I will start a campaign against you in the Western states, and you will lose the next congressional elections, which are coming up. Not only does he say this, but he actually primes the fuse. He gives some interviews, a few articles start to appear on the West Coast. Wilson, interestingly enough, then goes along to a meeting of the council, and the council votes 11 to 16 in favour of the Japanese amendment. 11 to 16. Wilson says, failed. Didn't pass. It has to be passed unanimously. Now, there's nothing in the regulations agreed for the conference that says that's the case. Wilson then goes to his advisors afterwards, changes the regulations for the conference retrospectively, writes it into the covenant of the League that this is the case, and justifies himself. Now, why does he do this? Well, we find, if we look at the archives, that Colonel House says, isn't it wonderful? Billy Hughes has argued our case for us. Billy has managed to take all the flak from the Japanese and everybody else for being a racist, and we Americans look like good guys, but have managed to sneak through. So when the big legions are on Billy's side, he wins. Even if it's by indirect means. Interestingly, in his notes at this time, he says of the Japanese amendment, it may be all right, but sooner than agree to it, I'd rather walk into the Seine or the Folie Bergère with my clothes off. Now, that would have been a sight. In other words, it would have been domestic political suicide for Hughes to do it. As it indeed it would have been for Wilson. The Japanese, while this is going on, Hughes goes to talk to the Japanese about it, and he says to the Japanese, what's more important to you, Shantung, concession in Shantung, or racial equality? Baron Makino, who's the principal Japanese diplomat, he's not the leader of the delegation, the leader doesn't go to anything, he sort of sits up there as a Japanese genro, but there's Makino. And Makino says, oh, Shantung's much more important. Okay, we'll make a show of arguing for racial equality, but we won't go to the wall about it as long as you vote for Shantung. The British Empire then agrees to Shantung, the French agree to Shantung. After all, they've taken all these other places, and that's what happens. And racial equality disappears from the agenda for another 20 years. So careful American diplomacy, as it were, shifted the blame to Australia. There's a piece in House's diary which says, quote, it has taken considerable finesse to lift the load from our shoulders and place it upon the British, by which he means the Australian, but it has been done. Hughes again then was a scapegoat for the great powers, but he's a willing scapegoat. Short-term opprobrium in right-thinking liberal internationalist circles was something Hughes was happy to bear, provided he gained the substance of his policies. As is the case over New Guinea, he most certainly did, and also on racial equality. The area he failed in was to get financial reparation for the war. It cost Australia £460 million to fight the war. He wanted the Germans to pay that, because if the Germans had paid that, they'd have had to pay for the rest of the war, and that would have been rather difficult. But he does manage to get, and this is something that doesn't appear much in the literature, if it does, it's not priced. He gets the island of Nauru, or roughly a third of the island of Nauru. Now, we know what the island of Nauru was, it not quite is anymore. It's guano, bird shit. The whole of the island is phosphate. He gets estimated £168 million worth of guano to be mined over the next 30, 40 years. The Australian farmers are delighted. as to the graziers. The grass is going to grow more. Wool's going to grow, wheat's going to grow more. So he gets that compensation. So that's what he gets when he doesn't manage. He can't get direct reparations. Okay, we'll go the other way. Now, Hughes is actually one of the three British principals on the Reparations Commission. And he argues, interestingly, the classic case for reparation. Hughes is a QC, or KC, I should say. He argues on the classic legal principles that Germany must bear full cost for the war because restitution needs to be made for the wrong that they've done. So a classic case that you make in any court of law. A line initially also argued by Lloyd George and Clemenceau. The American lead, however, was a brilliant young lawyer, becomes much more famous 40 years later, 30-year-old John Foster Dulles. He argues that the armistice was a contract. The 14 points armistice was a contract with the Germans, and the armistice doesn't allow for any restitution other than for paying for the rebuilding of Belgium and bits of northern France that had been destroyed by the Germans. The Americans then say, we'll agree to a war guilt clause. Tell the Germans they're guilty for the war. Don't have to pay for it necessarily, but they have to be guilty for it. So accept the war guilt clause. Some other supporters for the reparations fall away at this point. He then says to the French, well, we've only got so much money we can get from Germany. If we give it to the British Empire, and we give it to the Australians, and we give it to everybody else that's involved in the war, you French won't get as much as you would have otherwise. So the French change their tune, and the Belgians change their tune. Suddenly, Hughes is left, oh, by the way, Lloyd George has won an election saying he's going to squeeze the Kaiser till the pipsqueak, remember? Wins this election. The moment he wins the election, he changes his tune. We can't have the German economy collapsing. They'll all become communists. The Bolsheviks can't have that. We need the German economy. It's one of the biggest economies in Europe. Heard this argument before? We need the German economy. Therefore, don't squeeze them too hard. And Keynes says, don't squeeze them too hard. Lloyd George changes his tune, and Hughes is left in a minority one. No reparations. Spitting, cursing, but he gets guano. So that was something. Thank goodness for Nauru. At first sight, then, Hughes's politicking was effective enough to win for Australia and the British Empire, behind Australia, if you like, control of the strategically vital German New Guinea, the resource-rich island of Nauru, and his audacity and brinkmanship safeguarded white Australia against a Japanese challenge. He was successful over obtaining the Pacific Island mandates because Britain, France, Japan, Italy, fellow dominions, South Africa, New Zealand, and ultimately even the United States were behind him. This isn't in his book. Similarly, over white Australia, he was a cat's paw for South Africa, Canada, and again the United States, and Britain, which also had racially restrictive immigration of a sort. So they cynically allowed themselves to be convinced in him to take the blame. On total reparations, where despite egging on from France and elsewhere initially, he proved to be a lone voice among the main delegates, he had no success at all. Hughes's David only prevailed over the American Goliath when he had powerful legions behind him. It wasn't just the slingshot. And more important, Goliath was willing to play along with the act. Thank you.
The time is fine. Everything's fine. I've enjoyed being your assistant. Reminding me of the old days.
Always need a fidus acetes.
So many thanks for a great presentation tonight. As I said, copies of William Hughes, Australia, one of the makers of the Modern World series, the peace conferences of 1919 to 23 and their aftermath by Professor Carl Bridge. We've got some copies for sale tonight. So now we get to questions and discussion. You've started off by telling us, just to complete the picture, because obviously from what you've presented tonight, Hughes is a very clever politician, both in the national stage and the international stage. He becomes leader of the Labour Party, Prime Minister of Australia, moves across to the non-Labour side of politics, wins three elections, and then he's out. So how did that come about, but by 1922, this most successful politician is out of the job as Prime Minister.
A couple of reasons. I mean, there's the wonderful story he tells late in life. They say, why didn't you ever join the Country Party, Mr Hughes? You were in every other party. And he said, you've got to draw the line somewhere. I found rather nice. But the short answer is the Country Party. The prices that he negotiated during the war for wheat and wool were good, but at the end of the war and for the immediate post-war years, he's locked into British price agreements that mean he's selling his products under the market rate in the rest of the world. They could have made more, in other words. The Country Party, on the back of that, former party, breakaway from the Liberals, by Labour Party starts to put itself back together again after the war. By 1922, Country Party and the Labour Party are capable of overturning Hughes. There's also an element of hubris in there, I think. I mean, Hughes thinks he can do anything by this stage, and he can't.
So the Country Party say we'll stay in government with the Nationalists, provided Hughes.
Provided Hughes isn't Prime Minister, we want to get rid of those National Labour people. They're not really us. They never really were us. We had to put up with them during the war, but we don't put up with them now. And you end up with Bruce and Page.
Chris. Good evening, Professor. Just on a wider aspect, the Treaty of Versailles was signed on the 5th anniversary of the assassination of Austrian Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Germany was made to take all the guilt. How come Austria got out of it so freely?
They didn't. There was another treaty being negotiated that hadn't been finished yet. So there are two more treaties. There's a treaty with three, actually. There's one with the Hungarians, because the Austrians have divided by then, and there's one with the Turks. So they're still going. Hughes has gone home by then. We're not interested in those ones.
There's a question here.
When I say that, there's a little bit of interest because the graves at Gallipoli are on Turkish soil, and we want to make sure that they're not desecrated. So there's an aftermath there.
Yes.
Concerning the dominions, why were the dominions allowed a seat at Versailles? And what was their level of governance at that time in foreign policy?
There's a long answer and a short answer to this. I mean, when we put this proposal to DFAT initially, they said, but we didn't exist. We didn't have a department in those days. We didn't have a department of foreign affairs or even external affairs. We had a department of external affairs, but we had no officers during the First World War. We couldn't have possibly had a foreign policy. Well, what we did have was a government-to-government policy within the empire that actually acted as though it was a foreign policy. So de facto, the dominions are self-governing. Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Newfoundland at the time, South Africa, they're self-governing, so they control their own finances, they can control their own contribution to the war, but they are under a single crown. So legally speaking, the high contracting party, I think the legal term was at Versailles, was the king of the British Empire. So what we do is to sign under B for British Empire. If you have a look at the treaty, we're under B, not under A, and we're indented along with all the other ones. So we're signing on behalf of the King of England, essentially, because he is still our single monarch. Now, it's not until 1931 that you have a divided crown, where you end up with... we don't actually call him King of Australia or Queen of Australia until 1954, but legally speaking, after 1931, the Irish can have their own king and the Canadians and so on, which leads to the ridiculous situation where Ireland's neutral during World War II and the rest of us are involved. But that's another story.
Question up there.
Cal, anyone who reads anything about Billy Hughes knows that he was a colourful character, a very clever politician. But in terms of, and Wilson called him a something varmint and whatever, it sounds like there was more than just negotiating deals and politics at play. There was also personality. Can you give us an idea of how those two characters, Wilson and Billy Hughes,
I left that bit out, but yes, I mean, we all know versions of the hearing aid story. And Billy could hear in one ear, and he had a thing called an acousticon, which was a big box. That was his hearing aid. He used to go into meetings and put it on the table. And if he wanted to hear what you were saying, he'd say that he heard you, and if he didn't want it, he'd ask you to say it again, and he'd fiddle with his hearing aid. But he did this to Wilson. or so the story goes. It's not in the official records. It's wiped from the official records, but in the French version, private version, Hughes's own version, what happens is he goes and he says, I want to annex New Guinea. Wilson said, you can't do that. That's against the principles of the armistice. It's against the League of Nations covenant that we're trying to negotiate. And Hughes says, I represent 60,000 Australian war dead. Yes. Now, blood sacrifice. The Americans had lost 50,000 in the war, and they hadn't been in it for very long. They joined a bit late, remember? Mind you, we needed them. And the French are roaring with laughter, of course, when he says this, and everyone else. And Wilson said, replies, this has got nothing to do with it. Hughes says, I didn't hear you, Mr. President. He gets Wilson to repeat himself three or four times, which, of course, ups the ante the whole time he's doing. He knows what he's doing. He used to do this sort of thing all the time. So Hughes is, a bit like Everett later on the rambunctious side of Australian diplomacy, if you like, and of politics. Hughes is famous as a union negotiator. Little bloke, you go into a room full of wharfies. He was the leader of the wharfies at one stage before they went completely to the left. And they don't want to be on strike, and Hughes had talked them out of it. Talk them out of it. And he did it with miners. I'll get a deal for you. Then he'd go to the mine owners. He'd go to the owners of the ships, and he'd say, your ships are going to be destroyed if you don't do something. What are we going to do? And he'd broker a deal, a bit like Bob Hawke later on. Mm-hmm. He was that sort of character. Brilliant. But because he's such a caricature, as it were, and he plays on that as well, people remember that, and the fact that he's a Labour rat. Well, who deserted whom and why, and who won the next three elections? But anyway, we'll never change that. We historians might want to argue that. And Jeff knows this full well, is he? we'll never change it because that's in the popular imagination. My favourite Hughes story is the one about Menzies. And Menzies is Prime Minister, and Hughes wants to contest the Prime Ministership. This is in 1939. He said, Menzies couldn't lead a flock of homing pigeons.
Now, Carl, you're heading to the Waterside Workers' Federation central office. You better come back this way. In memory of Billy Hughes. There's a question here. Yeah.
Thank you for the talk. Look, just something I was thinking about, your underlying thesis that effectively Australia got what it wanted, partly because it was adverse. Well, everyone else wanted the same thing. Isn't it also the fact that Australia got what it wanted, one, because they made a fantastic contribution to the war, probably far beyond the level of their of their size and commitment, and secondly, isn't it the fact that probably no one else had as much economic interest or involvement in Papua New Guinea as Australia did, and that's probably no one else cared as much as Australia over
there. Yeah, I mean, it's true about New Guinea. In terms of contribution to the war, we make quite a significant contribution to the war, but the New Zealanders make more per capita, the British make more per capita, the Canadians, interestingly enough, have conscription, but they're slightly less than us because they have so many exemptions. It's very interesting, that's the way the Canadians operated. Major contributions. So the thing is, everybody bleeds in the First World War. The Americans bleed a bit less because they join late. They'd stayed longer than they... A lot of Russians die. So I don't think the blood sacrifice... I mean, we make that argument and it matters, and it's why we're there at all, because we were significant allies. We didn't break through the Hindenburg line alone in 1918, which is what if you believe the ABC, you'd think that was the case. Go to the Hindenburg line, there are seven or eight different memorials. First ones to get through were the Ox and Bucks at the Riekeveld Bridge, if you do your sums. We were there, yes, so was everyone else. And that's the case with a lot of things. Gallipoli, more French die at Gallipoli than Australians. They happen to be black French from the Cameroon and places. So they're not Cameroon, whatever it is, somewhere in East West Africa. The French have made a TV program called Les Dardanelles, which is all about this, never shown on Australian television. Senegal, that's probably
there's
right.
Yeah.
Cameroon's German.
Thank you. I'm just thinking, I'm assuming the dialogue between Hughes and Wilson was the first major interaction between Australian and American leaders. I'm just wondering, is that right?
Depends what you mean. Face to face, yes.
Face to face.
I mean, Deakin does stuff earlier, but yeah.
But then, and just how you, there's been analysis about how that sort of shaped the next sort of 5-10 years of discourse between, or and beyond, you know, between Australia and the US. Not so much perhaps between at that leaders level, but think about those prominent figures that were in the broader US delegation, thinking about the Antipodean nation and where we stood in the scheme of things, and how that started, obviously, the trajectory to where, towards where we are today.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Hughes says, when he's in the US in 1918, we need to have diplomatic representation in the US, which we didn't have at the time. We don't in fact, have it until Casey goes there in 1940. And the government back home says, oh, we can't afford that. It's not really worth it. We don't trade enough with them, blah, blah, blah. We'll send a trade representative. So Braddon, who's the Premier of Tasmania, former Premier of Tasmania, gets appointed trade representative in New York. He's there for a while, and I think he has one person succeeds him, and then they withdraw the trade mission. So the Americans, as it were, pull back on themselves. We get, when we try to borrow money in New York in the early 20s, Queensland does it, and the federal government thinks about it. It costs a lot more to borrow in New York than it does in London, so we keep doing it in London. So there's a... Yeah, we pull back a bit. We watch the movies, we buy the cars, we do all sorts of stuff, you know, Charlie Chaplin, all that stuff, but we don't necessarily get directly involved with the Americans until the Americans start coming out of themselves again in the late 30s. So it's a mixed story.
Are we getting towards the end of the question there?
I'm just wondering, has anyone been able to calculate the number of electorates he represented in the federal parliament?
I can't remember how many, at least three. It might have been several more. North Sydney, Ballarat, West Sydney, yeah. And there's he's also West Sydney, New South Wales Parliament before that. I think there might be one other.
Bradfield,
yeah. Well, that's West Sydney enlarged, yeah.
Okay, so we're getting near the end, so I'm just going to ask the final question. We don't usually do counterfactuals, but if Hughes hadn't been at Versailles, would it have made any difference?
We'd have had Joseph Cook, perhaps.
No, I mean, as to the Treaty of Versailles, well, we could have had Cook, but not having such a strong argumentative type as our leader, would it have made difference to the outcome of the conference?
It's a very interesting thought. I mean, there are two ways of achieving these things. You can achieve them by direct confrontation, or you can achieve them by negotiation. Hughes does a mixture. Our normal way of behaving at that stage was to try to do things internally within the British Empire delegation. Cook did a lot of the backroom stuff on New Guinea, as did Latham, who was his principal advisor at the time. Of course, he becomes Chief Justice. So it's not Hughes acting alone, even within the Australian legation. Of course, there are others as well. He's got his private secretary. Eggleston's there, but Eggleston's writing his diaries and criticising Hughes and doesn't do much at all. Percy Dean is involved in doing a lot of his legwork. Murdoch's there, but interestingly enough, Murdoch has a big falling out with Hughes because he likes Wilson. He falls in love with the US and falls in love with Wilson. Hughes, out.
Many thanks. I'm going from memory, but as I recall, Kim Beazley once said that Australia was never so influential on the world stage as it was in the period 1918-1919, and I think that's true. And with the anniversary of the First World War, we've had a lot of discussion about 1418, but we haven't had so much discussion about 1919-1923. And so in your book, which you put out some years ago, in your forthcoming documents, and in your speech here tonight, you've made it very clear how important Australia's role was, and how a man like Billy Hughes, who's had a lot of critics in his time and a lot of people laughing at him, was such a significant political leader both at home and abroad. So you've cut your paper down tonight to fit in with our time span, and we're grateful for that. Your full paper will be published in the Sydney papers. Sky News is here tonight, on the podcast tomorrow. A great performance, well done, and good luck.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.